This is nice. I like this. Very, very happy to be here and to see everyone. I just walk into the Zendo and I'm a happy person right away, because all of our long years of practice together and knowing one another, you can feel it. You can feel it in the air. I feel it in my breath and my body. It's so great to see everybody growing in maturity and compassion, the whole Sangha being a house of blessings for so many people. So great to see Connie in the Shuso seat. So this is my idea of a good time. for those of you who are pros at this, you know, I've been doing this a long time, I wanted to share with you some little picky point that I just learned, like I think yesterday, maybe last night, and I just wanted to share this with you. For those of you who can appreciate this, this is a little esoteric thing, but since it's on my mind, I wanted to share it with you. I was reading a review of a sort of obscure scholarly book about Buddhism. It was a review by Griff Folks, who's a scholar I know from the Midwest. Actually, now he's in the Sarah Lawrence. So in the course of reviewing this book about a 17th century Chan master, he got into a discussion of the term Genjo Koan that many of you will be familiar with, Dogen's famous term. And Griff points out, he's kind of criticizing the scholar for not knowing this. What's wrong with this scholar for not knowing this? And he's telling us this, that the actual origination of the phrase in Japanese, Genjo Koan, I don't know exactly what it is in Chinese, but the origin of the phrase is from the sayings of Yunmen. And Yunmen is quoting another teacher, Muzhao, who had the habit, whenever a student would come to study with him, when they would walk in the gate, he would start hitting them immediately. That was his usual practice. But once a student came, and he looked at them and he said, you are such an obvious case that I don't even need to hit you. That word, that phrase, that obvious case is Genjo Koan. In other words, completely self-evident. And I never heard this before either. Griff points out that the Chinese characters for case, Koan or Gongan in Chinese, that the first character means desk, like a magistrate's desk, like a lawyer, like in a court, a lawyer's desk. That would be where the cases, legal cases, would pile up on the lawyer's desk. So it came to mean a legal case, a precedent, a legal case. Yunmen said this in long before there was the idea of koans or, you know, cases, Zen stories that were used in the way that we are used to hearing them used. So it was the first use of that term, a self-evident or obvious case. And in Soto Zen, there's a whole other discussion, you know, about the phrase Genjo Koan. And in that discussion, they actually never reference the original use of the term. And to make a long story short, a very long story short, in Soto Zen, Genjo Koan really, really means the koan arise of our life, of our lives, not only like an issue of our life, but also just that we open our eyes and see a world is already. How could that be? What is that? So that's usually, something like that is usually how Genjo Koan is interpreted, but it's nice to think of it as an obvious case, a self-evident case. So anyway, I just wanted you to know that I learned that yesterday, in case you're interested. And it's such a wonderful thing to me when you think about it, you know, because that's right, isn't it? Life is such an obvious case, such a self-evident phenomenon. Everything that happens, every person we meet, every moment that arises, it's like, no, there it is, right? It is so what? Every minute. It's such an obvious and self-evident case that everything is all the time exactly as it is, exactly as it has to be, exactly perfect, exactly self-evident, and totally obvious. And the fact that we don't notice this and don't appreciate this, and that we're constantly looking for some other thing to be the case, is why we're always suffering so much, right? What if everything that ever happened to you, you said, this is the most marvelous thing. I can't believe I'm so fortunate. Even if it's something horrible, right? I can't believe I'm so fortunate that this has happened. What if we actually felt that way about everything that ever happened to us? It would be a totally different life, wouldn't it? And in fact, it doesn't make sense to feel any other way. Anyway, Griff Folks is a very funny, smart guy, and I wanted to share that little detail with the pros in the room. So, in our Dharma seminar at home, we've been bringing up stories about the famous Layman Pong. And Layman Pong, everybody actually knows about Layman Pong, because Layman Pong, in one of his poems, he had the phrase about chopping wood and carrying water. And so everybody knows this is like a buzz phrase of Zen. What is Zen? Chopping wood, carrying water. And I think the line was something like, you want to see a tremendous miracle? I'll show you my miracle. Chopping wood and carrying water. So anyway, we've been studying for about 6 or 8 weeks stories of the Layman Pong. There's a text, the sayings of Layman Pong, that's very famous in the tradition. So I want to repeat here a key point that I've been making throughout our studies as we've been thinking, you know, what are we learning from this text? The Layman Pong, most of the Zen stories are about monastics, you know, clerics, people who live in monasteries, travel on the road from monastery to monastery. But this is a whole text about a layman Pong. And he's not exactly an ordinary layman. The story goes that he put all his possessions on a boat, sailed the boat into the middle of a deep lake, and sank it. He didn't even want to give it to charity, you know. He just thought, this is such a problem. I don't want to pass this problem on to somebody else. I'll just sink the boat. And then he gave up his position in life and became a person who was dedicated to nothing else but Dharma, living with his family, who all of whom were also dedicated to Dharma. But the fact that he's a layman, you know, who has now given up his roles as a lay person, so he has nothing to protect, he has no axe to grind, no tradition or establishment or doctrine to uphold, so he just devotes himself to simple practice, and especially, as we learn in the text, what he loves to do more than anything else is visit all of his Zen cronies. All his best friends were all Zen teachers, and to hang out with them and engage in Zen dialogues. That's what he really likes to do the best. So these stories of Layman Pong differ from the usual Zen stories in that they're very relaxed and easygoing dialogues between good Zen friends. Nobody's teaching anything to anybody. Nobody's trying to straighten anybody out. They're just indulging themselves in the joy of bringing up the Dharma together. And this is a joy that I hope that we at our everyday Zen sanghas, including here at Red Cedar, I hope that this is a joy that we all share and all participate in. The Dharma is truly a wondrous thing to contemplate. And it's beautiful to practice, you know, just even if you, for no reason, you don't even need a reason, right? It's a beautiful thing to sit in silence together, you know, with a loving feeling of just being together. We don't have to talk to each other. We don't have to find out that she hates the thing that I like. You know, we don't have to worry about any of that. We just sit together kindly. And bring up and explore the truth, whatever that is, knowing that probably we don't understand it. Probably we're never going to understand it. But since we're human beings, we want to try. We can't give up trying our best to understand what our lives are really about. This is something, I think, that is true in all human communities, not just the Zen community or the Buddhist community, but all human communities have this need to share together at this deep level. You know, we get exhausted with trivial and controversial talk, but we all want and need to share deeply in some kind of exploration of life's most mysterious purpose and meaning, even though it's totally self-evident, totally obvious. And yet, we have minds and hearts, and we always ask questions that we can't answer. How come we were born? How come there's this beautiful planet spinning in space and we are existing exactly produced by this planet to be as we are? Why? And what are we supposed to be doing? What is this? What's going on here? And what's it about? And why does it happen? We don't know, you know. We're never going to know. And yet, we're going to ask, and we're going to share our thoughts and feelings about this. This is what we do. And that's what Layman Pong is doing with his friends in story after story in this very particular and weird constructed ancient Chinese way. So with that, I'll bring up a couple stories and say a few words about them. There's a text by James Green, a translation of the sayings of Layman Pong, and that's where I'm getting these translations from. This is the 27th story, and Green gives them titles, Not Violating the True Self, Not Violating the True Self. So here's the story. When the layman arrived at Master Changzi's place, the monks were assembling for a discourse as he entered the temple grounds, just like you guys were entering a minute ago, preparing for the discourse, exactly the same situation. And while they were coming in, the layman Pong stood outside as they filed in, and he said to each one as she came in, speak from your own experience. If you're going to ask a question, you know, don't ask a theoretical question. Speak from your own experience. So each one heard this from him as they came in. So then the lecture happened, and Layman Pong had a special place to stand at the right side of the teacher's lectern. And when the Dharma talk was finished and it was time for questions, one of the monastics said, could you, Master, please speak without violating the true self? So Changzi, in response to this question, said, are you acquainted with Mr. Pong? And the monastic said, I am not acquainted with him. Thereupon, Layman Pong sprang forward, grabbed the monk by the lapels, stuck his face right in his face, and said, "Is it that hard to be acquainted with me? Is it that hard?" And the monk, of course, didn't know what to do, and the layman let go of him. And that was the end of that. Later on, Chongzha asked Layman Pong, "Would it be worthwhile taking a stick to that monastic?" And the layman said, "What have you been waiting for?" And Chongzha said, "The layman only knows how to work with an awl, A-W-L. You all know what an awl is? It's like a sharp pointed instrument to poke holes. If you want to put you lost weight and you want to put another hole in your belt buckle, you get an awl and you poke a hole. So the layman only knows how to work with an awl. He doesn't know how to work with a chisel." The layman then said, "Then you wouldn't say something meaningful to a person if someone else overhearing it couldn't understand it?" And Chongzha said, "Why wouldn't someone else understand it?" And the layman said, "The master only knows how to work with a chisel. He doesn't know how to work with an awl." So that's the story. This is two guys having shop talk. And it's a little bit intricate and inside baseball, because the subject matter of the story is one of the favorite subjects in Zen stories. It's often discussed, especially when you have two old adepts involved. And that subject is, how do you share and demonstrate the teachings? It's kind of like a pedagogical question. You know, how do you do this? How do we help people to appreciate these teachings and the meaning behind them? Since the teachings can't exactly be explained in a kind of reasonable way, since any reasonable explanation and demonstration is inevitably going to be misleading and might even, you know, lead to the opposite of what you intend, you know, increase rather than decrease confusion. And anyway, since people are so different, you know, one from another, and people's preconceptions are so different, and besides that, some people are, you know, very experienced in the practice, other people are new, and it's very complicated. How are we going to do this? How are we going to pass on this great tradition, keep it alive, because it helps people? How do we do it? So this is the pedagogical dilemma, and it's a serious problem, and lots of Zen stories deal with it. Now, it seems that in other kinds of Buddhism, you don't have this problem. In other kinds of Buddhism, it's pretty much accepted that you can explain the teachings and, you know, do it this way, not that way, here's how it works. But in Zen, one of the main points is that the real teaching, the most important teaching, resists explanation. So in Zen in particular, you have this sort of problem. So you might ask, why would that be? Why is that? Why do the Zen teachings emphasize the impossibility of ordinary expression to explain the teachings? It's not just to be, you know, cute or baffling or outrageous or paradoxical. It's because it's the specialty of these old Chinese wise people who pass this specialty on to us to see that it is exactly our deeply, deeply embedded and fundamentally erroneous explanations of reality that are the real basis of our suffering. And that our suffering is built into the very structures of our language and thought not that easy to deal with it. So this is a really hard point. How, if this is true, and it's actually not only Zen that sees that this is true, it's all of Buddhism that understands this point, but it's Zen that specializes in focusing on just this one point. If this is the case, how are we going to understand anything and live differently if we're stuck inside language and the structures of thought? And yet somehow we can. How? That's the question that is being discussed in this story. How can we help people to see this? The first point in the story is clear enough, and I think not hard to understand. When the layman tells all the monastics, speak from your experience, don't speak theoretically, don't ask what you think you're supposed to be asking, don't make the Dharma some external thing that you think you're supposed to be mastering. Come from your heart, come from your own experience, come from your own suffering. Get down to what really matters in this human lifetime. That's why you're going into the hall for the talk. Don't think it's some abstract talk about Buddhism or Zen. Come with your whole heart. When the text says the layman stood to the right of the teacher, it sort of indicates that it was known, could be seen, that he had a special place, that he was a friend and an experienced practitioner. Again, for you professionals to note that they used to stand for the Dharma talk. We always sit, you know, in Japanese Zen we sit, but in Chinese Chan they always stood up. The teacher would sit down, but everybody would stand up. So if the teacher droned on for like an hour and a half, they were all standing there. A lot of times recorded Dharma talks will end with the teacher saying, well, you've been standing there a long time, I'm going to stop talking now. Little footnote. Anyway, so he gave his Dharma talk probably, and probably it was about the true person. He probably quoted a whole bunch of stuff and went on and on about the true person. So the first question after the talk is about this. And of course, the true person that you are, that I am, pretty hard to define, right? Language won't do it. Probably the master gave a Dharma talk that left more questions than answers. So that's why the first question is, can you please say something about the true person that doesn't violate the true person? Because I get it that everything you would say about the true person sort of like messes it up. So can you say something that doesn't mess it up? How can we speak of it? And if we can't speak of it, how are we going to understand who we really are? This is the thing we have to do, right? We have to understand not the person that we are conditioned to think we are, not the person that our mixed up thinking projects, but the person we really are. That's the only way, you know, we're going to end our suffering, is to know who we really are. So yeah, this is a question from the heart. And in response to it, Chuangzi refers the monastic to Layman Pong, a true person right in front of him. But the monastic misses this. I'm not acquainted with him, he says. As if all of us were not intimately acquainted always with one another. The true person is not some Buddhist abstraction. The true person is constantly appearing right in front of us as a very obvious case. Look in the mirror and see the face of the true person. Look at the sky. Look at every leaf, every twig. Look at the face of every person you will ever meet. Very obvious. All we have to do is stop thinking it's something else. Some other place, some other time, some other person, some other possibility that we are painfully now lacking. So, the layman, when the monk says, I don't know the true person, the layman grabs him by the lapels and says, look, look, it's right in front of you. What's the big deal? So this is the famous Zen style, right? The sudden style. It's always right in front of you. It's never anywhere else. You are, at this moment, your true self, no one else. Even as you're yearning to be your true self and convinced you're not, even in that moment of yearning and being convinced you're not, you are. Your true self is always here and gone. Here and gone. Obvious, self-evident, ungraspable. So maybe someone can shock us into it, hit us over the head with something, and boom, we'll see it right away. But the question is that the way to go about it? Is that the most helpful thing to do? Shock and awe? Is that the best way to wake somebody up? That's called the awl method, plunging in with an awl, poking a hole right through this artificial shell that we've all created that we call ourselves. Poke right through it. That's what Layman Pong is doing. So is that the best method, poking a hole? Maybe the chisel method is better. You know the chisel method, right? Like little by little, tap, 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 breaking down the shell, little by little, tapping until it's gone. Is that a better way to go about it? It seems better to me, you know, more gentle. But maybe not. Maybe it's better to be shockingly direct. As here, you know, Layman Pong startles this person. But maybe the person still doesn't understand anyway and ends up feeling humiliated or reinforced in the view they had in the beginning that they just are someone incapable of getting it. Now they're sure that that's true because someone poked them with it all and they still don't get it. So maybe it's better to just be kind. Think? Maybe. Maybe just be kind. But more than kind, don't be kind to regular people. Be kind only to awesome Buddhas who are regular people. Every regular person you will ever meet. Right? So maybe that's the best way, just to be kind to people, but not just like in a regular way, but kind with full respect for the truth of what every person really is. And maybe in that way, maybe it takes longer, but maybe little by little by little, people will start believing. Well, everybody's treating me like a Buddha. Maybe, who knows? I am worthy of respect. Ultimate respect. Who knows? Possibly, maybe I'm actually okay. Really okay. But maybe not. Maybe that isn't a good way to do it. Sounds nice. But maybe, you know, you're only coddling everybody, right? Maybe they'll never like, maybe they'll just continue in their folly, only now feel better about it. And maybe they'll, you know, they'll feel like, well, and I don't even have to practice or try hard because, you know, I'm being enabled here. So maybe we should like be hitting people and yelling and screaming at people. Maybe that's a better way. But that's what they're talking about. What's the best way to do this? What's the best way to go about this? This is a hard thing to do. How are we going to do this? Anybody, anyway, does anyone really think that there are some people who understand something, and therefore they can teach this to other people by whatever method. And then there's all these other people who don't understand and need to be straightened out by these other people who do understand and can straighten them out. Does anybody really think that that's true? To think that would not be obvious enough. It would be violating the self-evident reality of who we are. Anyway, after all that happened, sometime later, Layman and Chongzha have a conversation about these two methods of training. And Chongzha says, "What do you think about the fellow? Would it be worthwhile taking a stick to that monk?" And the layman said, "What have you been waiting for?" So it looks like Chongzha has been thinking about this monastic and how to help him. He's been waiting for the right opportunity. But the layman is saying, what are you waiting for? Why wait? You should always just plunge in right here, right now. Anytime. That's the way you go about it. And that's when Chongzha says, "The layman only knows how to work with an awl. He doesn't know how to work with a chisel." So they're talking about, you know, these methods. And so then Chongzha says, the layman responds, "Then you wouldn't say something meaningful to a person if someone else overhearing it couldn't understand it?" In other words, shouldn't we always express what we find to be true as it appears to us, no matter whether we think somebody can understand or not? Are we supposed to be like strategically holding our tongue and waiting for someone to be able to hear us? Wouldn't that be kind of false to be that way? Wouldn't we be robbing someone of a chance to hear something true? Anyway, somebody always hears the truth when we're bringing it up. It's kind of a stunning fact to realize that even when we think we're just sort of talking and not really revealing ourselves, we actually are. It's a kind of shocking thought. We're showing our whole insides all the time. Chongzha said, "Why wouldn't someone else understand it?" And you know, this to me is really great. Even when people don't understand, they understand. Even when we're not expressing it, we are expressing it. Maybe to think that there's some extra special Zen truth that we have in our back pocket and we just have to decide whether we feel like bursting out with it or not on any given occasion is already the worst possible mistake. It's already missing the obvious point. Maybe there isn't actually any difference between the awl method and the chisel method. Maybe there is no truth ever to be found that isn't always there right in front of us. Maybe it's always self-evident, and maybe when we make too much of it, we just make a problem. But the layman says, "Well, the master only knows how to work with a chisel. He doesn't know how to work with an awl." So he's saying, "Yeah, okay, well, there's different methods. You use yours, and I'll use mine. Maybe there's no difference anyway, but we're different people. We have our different styles." Just in case anybody wonders, we're a chisel-wielding bunch, I think. Not to scare anybody off, you know. Story number 30, Sungshan's staff. One day when the layman arrived at Sungshan's place, he saw that Sungshan was hewing a staff. So he said, "What's that in your hand?" And Sungshan said, "The time has come when this old monk cannot even take one step without support from this. So this is a great place to bring this up. We have several members of our community here this weekend who have a staff or a walker or something like that, so you know what that's about, right? I got to the place in my life where I got to have help in order to walk around. And the layman said, even though it's come to this, don't you still have some vitality left? So then naturally, Sung Shan whacked him with his staff. And the layman said, put down that staff for a minute and let me ask you something. And Sung Shan, being a very courageous and trusting person, did put down the staff. And the layman said, doesn't this old Chinaman have anything to say about what I just asked him? And Sung Shan didn't have the staff anymore, so instead he let out a big shout. And the layman said, from out of the clear blue sky, suffering arises. So this, to me, is such a sweet story. That wonderful last line, from out of the clear blue sky, suffering arises. In usual Buddhist discourse, we always say, suffering arises from causes and conditions. The nature of conditioned existence is suffering. That's the first noble truth. And the following truths say that once we can identify the causes of the suffering and we have a path for overcoming those causes, we can be free of the suffering. Suffering, cause of suffering, end of suffering, path. So in normal Buddhist discourse, suffering doesn't just come from out of the blue. There's a reason for suffering, and we can overcome it. But the layman is saying something a little different. He's saying suffering is just here. It arises pure and free, open and expansive, like the blue sky. To see the pristine and gorgeously clear nature of suffering is the Zen way. It's its deepest truth, a truth that is very hard to appreciate and takes long practice and lots of living to see. Anyway, as we see in this story, it looks like Sung Shan, like maybe one or two of the rest of us, is getting old. And he can't walk anymore without a stick. Maybe he's exaggerating, but maybe not. We don't know much about him, whether he was a lot older than Master Layman Pong, or maybe they were the same age, I don't know. Maybe it's like Layman Pong is a younger person. Sometimes younger people will make fun of older people. Come on, you don't need that thing. You're just lazy. My sons do that to me. You know, they'll say, let's go on a 72-mile hike. And I say, well, you know, maybe I'm a little old for that. And then they joke and they say, oh, no, come on, you're just being lazy. They think, you know, since they're young, they think everybody must be young, you know. And they remember me when I was, you know, to them, I'm probably still the father that they had when they were 16, you know. Now they're in their 40s. Or no, maybe not. Maybe Layman Pong is just as old as Sung Shan. Maybe he's chiding Sung Shan for not using what he has, which can happen, right? It's one of the hardest things, I think, about aging is you never know how old you actually are on a given day, right? Some days you're a lot older than you are in other days. You have to decide how old you are and what you can do and what you can't do on that particular day. And that can be hard. You know, I mean, at some point, I guess, you know, it's pretty clear. I'm not making it to even the base camp at Everest. Not going to happen. But there's a lot of in-between cases, right? where it's not entirely clear. Am I just pampering myself here and being lazy, and you know, or is it really true that I can't do this or that? So that's a problem that some of us have. We're dealing with it the best we can. But anyway, that's just an aside. That's not the main point here. The main point is the layman's question. Do you still have vitality? That's the question. As long as we're alive, even if we have one more minute to live, we are 100% alive. Nobody's dying, you know, any more than anybody is dying. We're either 100% alive or we're not. And this really is our practice. This is the way we live the obvious case. By committing ourselves completely to being 100% alive on every occasion. Anyway, life and death, do we have any idea what we're talking about? Who knows where we're going when we're done with this phantom body? And believe me, sit there long enough in Zazen, and you will not know what is this phantom body right now. Sungshan in this story is no slouch. When asked whether he has vitality, he hits the layman with his staff, and when he's asked again, he shouts at him, saying, in effect, yes, yes, life, life, right, here I am, without stint in my life. Right now. So he's right there at every step with the layman. Together, in their sharing the Dharma, they have gone beyond the ordinary human confusion of birth and death, sickness and old age. No such thing. Courageously, they are ready to face life 100%. And this is what makes the last line of the story so beautiful. This is life, right? From out of the blue, from nowhere, from everywhere, from the beautiful blue openness of the sky, from the preciousness and ineffability of life and death itself, suffering arises. And we stand in awe of it. And we face it and do what must be done with full appreciation, with courage, with no regrets and second guessing. This is our vitality. And this is our aliveness. And this is what we hope to appreciate through the ongoing process of our practice together. So thank you all for listening to my Dharma talk today, and thank you for your ongoing practice, and thank you for being a bunch of old Zen guys who enjoys bringing up these things for no particular reason.
Because they're obvious.
Because they're so obvious, right? So obvious. Yes, I often say it's embarrassing to give a talk, you know, about something so obvious. Okay, thank you.